Everybody dies. Everybody dies. All creatures die. That's the one great certainty of life, isn't it? And we know this, and yet how deeply do we really know it? So the Dharma tells us that everything that is born dies. Everything that has a beginning has an ending. Everything put together falls apart. Everything that arises in dependence on conditions ceases when those conditions cease. So recollection of impermanence and death is one of the central practices of Buddhism, and recollection of death, which we've been doing today during this festival, you could say is the cutting edge of the practice of recollection of impermanence. Now we can put it more poetically and less starkly than I've started off, and that might help us to absorb it. So there's a poem by Tsongkhapa which says, "All worldly things are brief, like lightning in the sky." So lightning is beautiful, isn't it? It comes in a flash, it illuminates, it passes away. And that's echoed in some lines in the Diamond Sutra, which says, "Like stars, a fault of vision or a lamp, a moksha, a dewdrop or a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash, a cloud, so should we view what is conditioned." And the poem by Tsongkhapa continues, and we must apply that to our own life. "This life, you must know, is a tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being. And the poem ends, therefore set your goal, make use of every day and night to achieve it." So those natural images, I guess they spark off our imagination. There's beauty and there's impermanence at the same time. So raindrops, dewdrops, bubbles. Now I've been on many a solitary in Wales, where it rains a lot, where it seemed to rain all the time. I lived in Wales for a long time. It does rain a lot in Wales. And I remember just sitting in a caravan and watching raindrops trickle down the window pane. Very nice meditation practice, actually. Very nice reflection on impermanence. Or watching the raindrop hanging on a fence outside the window. So the raindrop's there, isn't it? And then it's gone. Or it trickles down the window, and then it's gone. Each raindrop is beautiful. Each raindrop is unique. And each raindrop passes away. So Far Eastern Buddhism was very fond of the image of the dewdrop as a symbol for impermanence. They refer to this samsaric world, this conditioned world, this fleeting world, as this dewdrop world. And it's very beautiful, isn't it? It kind of evokes something in us. "Dewdrops on a blade of grass, having so little time before the sun rises." That's a line by Dogen. Or Ryokan, "Life is like a dewdrop, empty and fleeting." So we reflect that life is fleeting. This is the first great reflection in our recollections of death, that death is certain and that life is fleeting. But we also reflect that so many people have lived and died on this planet, so many creatures. So Kukai, in one of his poems, says, "Oh, have you not seen that billions have lived? None have been immortal, kings and beggars." So death is the great leveller. It doesn't matter how rich you are, how poor you are, how much, if you're a king or a beggar, death comes to everyone. "Transient as dreams, bubbles or lightning, all are perpetual travellers. Have you not seen this has been man's fate? How can you alone live forever?" So the message is trying to say, isn't it? And you, well actually it's not you, it's me, and me. So the Dharma's full of these kinds of teachings and images. And Bhante once said, if you could condense the whole of the Dharma into one word, that word would be impermanence. So death is certain, it's the great certainty of life. But death is also the great uncertainty, because mainly we don't know when or where or how, unless I guess you engaged in some kind of form of assisted dying and you know. So there was a survey done recently, apparently in England and Wales, that worked out that 85% of people die after the age of 65. So that's quite interesting, isn't it? That mostly people die later on in life. But we know probably from our own experience that beings, human beings, creatures, also die at all points in their life cycle. And reflect on this. And that we die from all kinds of causes and conditions. So we die from sickness, illness, infection, accidents, and sometimes even violence or war. So even if you were given a terminal prognosis, you still don't know exactly when you're going to die. My own experience of being with people who are dying is that it just takes its own time. Sometimes it can take quite a long time in that last phase. It's sort of a mystery, isn't it? It happens when it happens, as it were. Maybe even if you're in front of a firing squad, I don't know why I thought of that image anyway, something that's kind of, you think, oh, I'm going to die, right? It's here. Something could happen and stop that happening in that moment. And there's an article on the BBC website yesterday. It's quite a bleak incident, really, about a guy in Africa who was on death row, as it were, and he'd come up for his execution three times, and three times it hadn't happened because the guy who was doing the executions knocked off work, apparently. And then after that, the law changed, and he was reprieved. So it must have been very traumatic for him, but again, you just don't know what's going to happen until the actual time. So the message of this part of the recollection, that the time of death is uncertain, is be prepared. So you might say, well, why reflect on death? Isn't that a bit morbid? Isn't that a bit sad? Why would we do that? And how can we do it effectively? And why might we not want to do it? So I guess we do it, or it's a good practice, because it is certain, it is a fact, it's part of reality. Everything that's born, everyone that's born dies. So it's part of our experience of life, this intimation of death, however conscious we are of that. And as practitioners, of course, we're trying to turn towards reality, we're trying to turn towards the truth. So recollection of death helps us make that turning, as it were. I also think as a practice, it maybe highlights, well, what do I really want to do with my life? What are my priorities? And I think it can also heighten appreciation of life. Life becomes more vivid. And also I think it can give rise to compassion, because if we really have some intimation that we're going to die and everybody's going to die, it kind of opens our heart, doesn't it, to everybody else and all creatures, because we're all in the same boat. So it's not to say that trying to recollect death and dying is easy. Often we feel we want to avoid it, we resist, even we feel fear. And also we have sometimes, don't we, a sort of secret feeling that it really isn't going to happen to me. It might happen to everybody else, but not to me. It's very, very hard to have that sense that this is going to happen. I think it was Woody Allen who said, "I'm not afraid of dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens." But of course, as practitioners, we do want to be there when it happens, don't we, really? We want to be conscious and aware. So I think it's quite natural and normal that if you edge into those reflections on death and dying, that you may feel some fear. It's natural and it's normal, because we have a very strong survival instinct, a very strong life force. That's part of being who we are, isn't it? So that gets kind of challenged, and we have a very strong ego sense or ego identity, and that also gets challenged when we reflect on death. So I have a friend who has a terminal diagnosis, and recently she gave a talk at her local centre on what she'd learned in the last couple of years. It was a beautiful talk, it's on Free Buddhist Audio. It's like her, she's beautiful, she expresses herself beautifully, and it's very, very understated, but it's very clear and direct. And she said that she'd lost her fear of death. So I was very struck by that. That's quite something, to lose one's fear of death. And she says she remembers when it happened in her own experience, but she said she couldn't tell us how to do it. There's no recipe for it. But she said she could tell us that it was possible, that death was natural and normal, but not necessary. So that's a great encouraging message. At some point, it's like the conditions came together in her own existential situation that gave rise to that experience that she no longer feared death. And she's saying, well, that's possible. One can overcome the fear of death. But one of the conditions we need to turn towards impermanence and death and dying is we do need a really strong foundation of loving kindness, of metta, of love for oneself, of faith, of devotion, appreciation, all those very, very positive emotions. Because we don't want to fall into any kind of despair or nihilism. Or what's the point? That's not the point of the practice or the reflection. So my own experience of engaging in this kind of reflection on death and dying, which I do quite regularly, is when I do it and I engage in it wholeheartedly, I feel more alive, actually. I feel alive, I feel more alive, I feel invigorated. It's like life becomes more vivid. So it's interesting that one of the traditional Tibetan sets of practices precedes reflection on death and impermanence with a reflection on the preciousness of this life, this precious human birth, this precious human life. So the first line of that poem by Tsongkhapa is, "The human body at peace with itself is more precious than the rarest gem." cherish your body. So cherish your body. More precious than the rarest gem is very, very precious, isn't it? So our body, our life is precious to us. And we reflect on that. We need our body as a vehicle for practice. And we also reflect on all the conditions that have come together that enable us to practice the Dharma now. And if we engage in that reflection, there are so many things that have brought us to this shrine room now, today, enabling us to practice. That gives rise to confidence, and that gives rise to appreciation and gratitude. And then it's easier to turn towards reflecting on impermanence. So I thought I might get away with starting off in the rather stark way of saying, we're all going to die. Everybody dies. Even given the above caveat that we need a strong foundation of metta, because many of us will have been here since this morning in this atmosphere reflecting on death and impermanence. Reflecting on the last days of the Buddha and reflecting on the life and death of our own teacher and then of our loved ones who've died in the last several years. So we've soaked ourselves in a very positive atmosphere. If you've just joined us, you're also soaking yourself in that atmosphere that's been built up. So several years ago, I think it was 1983, Bhante gave a talk called Between the Twin Soul Trees, which is where the Buddha died. And in that talk, he said we could make more of Parinirvana Day. And he developed the program that we have today, the Vajrasattva mantra, reading the sutta of the last days of the Buddha and remembering those who've died. And he said he thought this festival would have a different mood or tone from the other festivals that we celebrate, Buddha Day, Dharma Day, Sangha Day, in that it would be more sober and reflective, but with a strong atmosphere of metta, of loving kindness. And that's certainly my own experience of this festival day. Hearing about the last days of the Buddha is deeply moving. And I think it brings the Buddha more alive in our immediate experience. Seeing photos of people who've died in the last few years on the shrine and hearing their names read out is also deeply moving. And I sat in this shrine room and many other shrine rooms on Parinirvana Day and heard the name of my own family and friends read out. And I'm very grateful that that's done in a collective atmosphere of well-wishing and support. It makes a huge difference, actually. I've also sat in this particular shrine room and heard someone weep almost inconsolably at a really deep loss. And yet again, that was held in this atmosphere of support and love. I think Sarigupta was saying earlier about each death and each loss is each life, and then each death and each loss is very unique, isn't it? Each life is unique, each loss is unique, and yet you sit here and you hear so many people have died, so many people in this shrine have lost people in the last year, and that really just opens your heart, doesn't it? It's not just about you, it's about everybody. So our community, Triratna community, this is a particularly poignant festival because we're remembering also the death of our teacher, Sangharakshita. So I'll come on to him a bit later. So I want to, having spoken about the first two recollections of death that we can do in the traditional sense, death is certain, the time and means of death is uncertain. There's a third part of that, but I want to explore that within the context of looking at an incident or two from the last days of the Buddha. So some of you were here this morning and heard readings from the last days of the Buddha, the Parinibbana Sutta. It's a long sutta, actually it's only the last sections that cover the last days and months of the Buddha's life. So he's about 80 at this point, and it becomes obvious that despite his old age, he's still wandering around northern India and revisiting all the places that he'd visited in his long 45-year teaching career. It says in the sutta that he travelled with a large company of monks, but in most of the scenes at the end, it seems he's just accompanied by Ananda, his faithful friend and companion of the last 25 years. And Vishvapani, in his book on the Buddha, says, "This was no grand progress. It was just the last journey of an old wanderer in his faithful companion." And I like that. I think that's very simple and very poignant. At a certain point in their journey, they stop for the rainy season. It's impossible to travel during the monsoon in India, so they stop. But the Buddha becomes sick. And I'd forgotten this part of the sutra until I reread it recently, and I was quite fascinated by this. So reading from the sutta, it says, "He was attacked by a severe sickness with sharp pains, as if he were about to die. But he endured all this mindfully, clearly aware, and without complaining. It's a lesson for us here, isn't it? He thought, it's not fitting that I should attain final nibbana, which is death, without addressing my followers and taking leave of the order of monks. I must hold this disease in check by energy and apply myself to the life force. So he did so, and the disease abated. So I find that fascinating. I'll come back to it in a minute. So not long after that, he has this conversation with Ananda where he says, oh, Ananda, I'm old, I'm aged, I've done my time. I'm like an old cart tied up with straps. But nevertheless, they keep travelling. So they keep on travelling from place to place, shrine to shrine. And this is quite delightful. Despite his old age and his obvious physical discomfort, he really enjoys the beauty of the various places that he visits. He says to Ananda, oh, Vesali, which is a great big city. Vesali is beautiful, it's delightful. The Udena shrine is delightful. The Kapila shrine is delightful. So something delightful about that, isn't there? That he's old, his body's not comfortable, he's still sleeping on the floor. But he deeply appreciates the atmosphere and the beauty of those places. And perhaps that's heightened by the fact that perhaps he knows it is going to be the last time that he sees each of those places. There is a line in the sutta where he looks back at Vaishali and says, ah, this is the last time I will see Vaishali, a place that he spent many, many times. So then something really quite mysterious happens in the sutta. I don't presume to understand it, but it fascinates me. At this point, Ananda, the Buddha hints to Ananda that the Buddha, if asked by Ananda, could extend his lifespan. So sometimes it says he could extend his lifespan for an aeon, which is a very, 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 very long time. And sometimes it just says, well, he's 80. It could mean that he could extend his life for 10 or 20 years to 90 or 100. I think that's probably more likely. So he hints, he can't tell Ananda to do this, so he kind of hints, and Ananda, poor old Ananda, doesn't get the hint. And the Buddha does it again, Ananda doesn't get the hint. Does it a third time, Ananda doesn't get the hint. So you might think, well, why doesn't he get the hint? He's the Buddha's faithful companion. Surely he would want the Buddha to live a bit longer. But Ananda's not fully enlightened at this point, so we can only presume or assume that he's overtaken by Mara, the evil one. It clouds his mind. So Mara comes to the Buddha at that point. Now Mara, we know from, Mara attacks the Buddha, doesn't he, at the Buddha's enlightenment and throws everything he possibly can at the Buddha, and all those weapons are turned to flowers. But he doesn't just disappear after. He keeps coming back to the Buddha. He keeps saying to the Buddha, now is the time for your final nibbana. Now is the time for you to die. And the Buddha has said so far, no, I'm not going to do that, Mara, sorry. And he says no because he says, not until my community of monks, nuns, and lay followers are accomplished, trained, and skilled and learned knowers of the Dharma, walking in the path of the Dharma, who will pass on what they've gained from their teacher, teach it, establish it, expound it, analyze it, and make it clear, and teach the Dharma of wondrous effect. So he wants to leave behind an established Sangha, which can both practice and communicate the Dharma. I think that's really beautiful, and you know, we can aspire to be ourselves that kind of Sangha. So until now, he said, no, I've not done that yet. I'm not going to leave this world. So now Mara comes again and says, no, you have done it now. Come on, Buddha, you've done it now. Now's the time. He can't really wait for the Buddha to be gone. He's waited a long time. He's waited 45 years. So Mara symbolises evil. He symbolises death. He symbolises the whole of conditioned existence over which he has power. He's the pull of the conditioned. But the Buddha has transcended all conditioned things. He's freed from Mara's power, which does not make Mara happy. So he longs for at least the physical presence of the Buddha to be gone from the world. And at this point, the Buddha says, don't worry, Mara. The Buddha's final passing will not be long delayed. 3 months from now, the Buddha will take final nibbana or death. So then the Lord at the Kapila shrine, the Buddha, mindfully and in full awareness, renounced the life principle. Now this is what I find fascinating, that he renounced the life principle. I think, what does that mean? How do you do that? What is that? And at that point, there's a great earthquake, as there often is in Buddhist suttas. And Ananda goes, ah, an earthquake, that must mean something, and goes to ask the Buddha what it means. And the Buddha says, there's lots of times when there's a great earthquake, when I get enlightened, when I first preach the Dharma, and when I renounce my life principle. Poor old Ananda goes, oh, oh, and desperately begs the Buddha to stay, but it's too late. He's missed his opportunity. The Buddha says, "If you had begged me, I could have refused twice, but not the third time." So the Buddha slightly chides Anna. This is quite mysterious. You know, he hints that he could extend his life. Why does he do that? Anna doesn't get it. We don't quite know why. Then he slightly chides Ananda for not asking him. But then he says, sort of paradoxically, "But have I not told you before that all things that are dear and pleasant to us must suffer separation and alteration and change? How could that not be possible? Whatever is born, become, compounded, is liable to decay. That it should not decay is impossible." So there's kind of sort of paradox here of him giving, you know, teaching on impermanence. So this is one of the things that's always fascinated me about this part of the story, that the Buddha relinquishes his life force or renounces his life force. And earlier when he was sick, he decides to suppress the illness and apply himself to the life force. So he's, of course, awakened. He's been awakened for many decades. He's a human being, but he's not an ordinary human being. He's an awakened human being. So he's transcended sickness, old age and death. He's transcended ego clinging. He's the trackless one, but he still has a body. That body is conditioned. That body was born. That body must die. So even a Buddha must die. What to say of us? So presumably the life force he relinquishes is tied up with the body. It's that deep instinctual survival instinct or desire to keep living, whatever. And it seems that he could consciously let go of that. That's fascinating, isn't it? I don't know how you do that. He could do that. And yet he could still keep going, as it were. Another 3 months, he's wandering, he's still teaching, he's full of compassion for his followers and his disciples. He doesn't fall into any kind of despair or nihilism, having given up his life force. So I think there's something very profound and mysterious here that I don't claim to understand, but what it says to me is that he lets go. He lets go of that survival instinct, that deep life force. And there must be a lesson here for us that we also need to learn to let go. So the life force and the survival instinct is very strong. This is part of what makes us human, isn't it? It's an animal instinct as well. But at some point, unless I guess we experience a sudden death, we will be in the dying process. And that is a process of letting go. And if we resist or avoid or we feel fear, it's going to be much more difficult for us. So some years ago, when my mother was unwell, she was dying, I looked after her for about 3 years. And for the last 6 months of her life, I lived with her and looked after her. So she was in her late 80s. She wasn't going to get better. Her mind was completely clear. She'd not had much sickness in her life, and she'd very sort of energetic woman. So she really loved life and she enjoyed life, and she didn't really want to die, even, you know, at that old age, as it were, until she got poorly. And even then, she didn't really want to die. But things progressed, you know, as they do. And then one day she said to me, "How do I let go? How do I let go?" She said, "I go to bed at night thinking, well, I might not wake up in the morning. And then come the morning, I wake up and here I am when I need to live my day, as it were, whatever that day involves." So it's very touching and very poignant, very ordinary woman with no spiritual practice or anything. But yeah, how do I let go? We had a bit of a joke because obviously she knew me, had known me for a very long time. And I was always a kind of awake child and an awake baby. And I said, well, maybe I'm not the best person to ask, because I'm the sort of person that, you know, I put my head on the pillow and I don't immediately go to sleep. So maybe I'm not the best person. So we had a bit of a joke. And then I said, but I guess it will happen naturally. It will just happen. You have to just trust the process, not worry about it, it will happen. And of course it did happen. I think it was some weeks later she died. And I was with her when she died. And although I felt loss and grief and sorrow later, at that moment when I knew she'd taken her last breath, I felt ecstatic. I felt completely ecstatic, because it wasn't about me, it was about her. She'd done this mysterious thing. You know, ordinary person, but in the dying process, she'd managed somehow, I don't know how, to let go and move on, as it were. So I was like, well done. So yeah, we all need to let go at the right time and in the right way. And this is what our recollection of impermanence and death can help us do. I mean, we're doing it all the time anyway, aren't we? We breathe in and breathe out, we don't hold our breath forever because we die. So we're always letting go in some way. It's making that more conscious, isn't it? Bringing that more into our awareness. So yeah, letting go, I think that maybe that's the lesson that the Buddha's relinquishing of his life force gives us. So coming on to the third reflection, recollection of death. So death is certain, the time of death is uncertain. And the third reflection is what helps you at the time of death and what do you need to let go of? So again, it's a focus on letting go. In tradition, there are three things that we've said we need to let go of at the time of death in the dying process. The first one is our possessions. Now, it may be you don't need your possessions when you're in the dying process. It doesn't really matter whether you're completely untidy, does it, or tidy, or cluttered, or uncluttered. Probably if you're very cluttered, I hope I'm not going to offend anyone here, it might be that you experience some regret because you kind of know someone else is going to have to deal with that. It may be that you've marie-condoed yourself up to the eyeballs and you only own things that spark joy, and all your things have gone to Lama's pyjamas. You let them deal with it, that may be where you are. And that may be lovely that you're only surrounded by things that give you joy, but even so, you're in a dying process, you have to let go of your possessions. And sometimes possessions include things like status and ego identity and those sort of things as well, wealth. So you have to let them go. So my family appears in this talk quite often. So my auntie was my mum's eldest sister. So she died in her kind of mid-80s, and she lived on her own in their childhood house, and she was a collector. So that house, three up, three down, apart from the little spaces that she lived and slept in, was full of stuff. It wasn't kind of untidy or dirty, it was just stuff. It was books and newspaper cuttings, and she was a stamp collector, and she collected everything. And she was very happy with her collections. She'd been a craftswoman, so there was kind of wool and embroideries, everything, you know, just tons of stuff, floor to ceiling. So she felt a little tired, she said, and so she booked herself into a nursing home, which sort of surprised my mum and I, and we thought she would come home. But she didn't come home. She just kind of went to this nursing home, and she sort of gently faded away. She had a very easy, beautiful death, really. And I think, well, she just had to leave all that stuff, didn't she? You know, she had to go somewhere where that wasn't, like, surrounding her, so she could just have this process. And she just left it all to my mum and me to sort out. It took us about a month, actually. So do declutter. Marie Kondo's not so bad. She's not so bad. Anyway, so possessions. So secondly, we're encouraged to let go of friends and family. Now, I'm sure if you've been to a death workshop and you're imagining your own deathbed scene, you do this in death workshops, bring your own deathbed scene, and you're completely surrounded, of course, by people who love you and rejoicing in your merits and so on. So that would be great if that was, you know, that was what happened. That would be wonderful. But still, in the dying process, you know, it's you alone that has to do it in the end. You have somehow to kind of let go of attachments to people. And so it is interesting, isn't it? Sometimes people die when everyone's just left the room for a moment. You know, it's as though that allows that person who, you know, who loves the people who are surrounding them to just let go and go on to the next stage, as it were. And then thirdly, our body. So our body's been our faithful companion since we were born. It's our precious human body. We need our body as a basis for practice, but of course at death, it's going to break down. So it's not that we don't need possessions. We need possessions in order to live. We need our body as our vehicle for practice. We love our families. We need our friends and our spiritual friends. But somehow holding all that within the context of knowing that we're going to die and just allowing ourselves to be a little less possessive about it, have more metta, more appreciation. And I suppose it just points out that at death we are on our own. In life, on our own. So then it's asked, what can we rely on? We can't rely on those things in this final death process. What can we rely on? And the answer, of course, is our Dharma practice. So it's our practice, our momentum of our practice. It's our practice that we've absorbed and made our own. It's the drop-by-drop skillful actions and resulting insights that shape our consciousness that we've absorbed. The fruits of our skillful habitual karma, as it were, the fruits of our practice. That's what we can rely on. That's what's going to be present in our life stream, as it were. So Bounty was once asked in a letter by someone, they wrote and said, if I had 6 months to live, what practice should I do? And he answered, it's an interesting answer, he said, there are no last-minute methods. No last-minute methods. So it's no point, you're in the dying process and you're thinking, what is that practice where you eject the consciousness at the top of your head and do you put a blade of grass in it or not, or water? It's not going to help, is it? It's really not going to help you at that point because you don't know what you're doing. So what helps you is the practices that you have the most faith in. The one that you're most familiar with, you have the most faith in. So that's going to be the practices that we do day by day. Obviously, you need to be doing those practices creatively, but the good old mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness practice, metta bhavana, Brahma Vihara practice, sevenfold puja practice. If you're an order member, it could be a sadhana practice. Your reflections on impermanence practice that you've done, that you've kind of engaged with over years. That's what's going to sustain you at the time of death. So all we've got really at the time of death, or perhaps any time, is our state of mind. That's what's most important, isn't it? And the more creative our state of mind, I imagine, the easier it is to let go at that point. So letting go is the theme. And again, if we think about, what would I want to be happening when I'm dying? Most people say, well, I'd like a good death. People mean different things by that. But one of the things people often mean by that, isn't it, is that you have no regrets, that you die without regrets, because that's going to kind of pull on you somewhere and kind of cause you disturbance in your mind. And many of our regrets, maybe not all of them, I have this thing that flashes, quite ironically, it flashes up on my screen and says, nobody ever regretted that they hadn't spent more time on the internet, but there it is on the internet. Anyway, it's from a group called You're Gonna Die. Anyway, it's quite funny. Yeah, so most of us want to die without regrets, and most of those regrets often involve other people, things that are left undone, unsaid, things not sorted out, because they're deeply emotional, aren't they? So we're encouraged in the face of death to, as it said in the sutta, to compose our quarrels. Others do not realise they are all heading for death. Those who do realise will compose their quarrel. That's the Dhammapada. So this, again, is a letting go. It's a letting go of old hurts, resentments, betrayals. Not easy work. I'm not suggesting for a moment that that is easy work. And it may be that the person, you can't go back to that person. It's not possible in some way. But you can do the inner work. You can start to work on those feelings. And we need to do that before it's too late, as it were, if we can make amends to the person. So I remember a good friend of mine dying a couple of decades ago, and she was quite far into the dying process. And at that point, I think when someone's dying, friends and carers, they just want to provide a peaceful atmosphere, enough care, enough pain medication, but then you just want peace and let that person do their journey, as it were. And she'd fallen out with a very, very good friend of hers. She tried to make amends or remake a connection, and there's no chance. But this person heard that my friend was dying, and at that point she wanted to come and kind of talk it all through and sort it out. And it was just too late. It was very, very sad. I mean, we engaged with her, but it wasn't appropriate for her to be there at that point. I think it wouldn't have been the right thing. But yeah, it was kind of poignant that she'd left it too late. And a more positive side, another member of my family is going to appear. I had quite a difficult relationship with my brother. Right when we were kids, we were just so different, and we didn't get on, we didn't understand each other. It was really not an easy relationship, and he spent most of his time abroad, so that was easy. But then a few years ago, he got in touch. I hadn't seen him for about 10 years, I think. He got in touch with me and said that he wasn't well and he wanted to come back to England for some treatment, and would I be involved in that? So I said yes. And when he came back, he was really very, very ill. He hadn't told us how ill he really was. So he was in a dying process, really. So, yeah, those couple of months while he was here were not easy, making that reconnection. The people who live with me and my friends will know they supported me through that. But in a way, it was a gift. It wasn't easy. It was very difficult, but it was a gift because we did meet and we reconnected. And the last time I saw him, and I didn't know it was going to be the last time I saw him, he was in a better state in that he was being better looked after. We'd found him a good nursing home. And so he was more able to communicate. And he thanked me for everything I'd done, which he'd never done ever before. And we just had this very unexpected connection, you know, quite deep connection. And then a few weeks later, he died. And I just always felt so grateful, even though it was so tough, that he came back and that we had that opportunity to mend our fences, as it were, and he was willing to do that. So it's important, if we can, to let go of our quarrels, to compose our quarrels. So that's all about letting go, and that's come out of the Buddha relinquishing his life force. So I want to move on. I want to just talk a little bit about our teacher, Ogyen Sangharakshita Bhante, his last couple of years, his last days. But before I do that, I want to go back and just let you know about a couple of earlier experiences of his coming to terms with death, because you might not know about these. So in early 1960, 1961, he writes in one of his memoirs, Moving Against the Stream, he says, "I knew that I would die, but that knowledge didn't go very deep." So that's like most of us, isn't it? He said, "And then I heard my friend Kantipalo speak on the subject of death at a course we were both on. Kantipalo didn't say anything that I hadn't heard before or read before or even given talks on before myself. But on this occasion, the familiar words took on a new and vital meaning and sank deep into my heart. I knew that I would die." So that's quite a strong incident in Bhante's own life. At that point, he knew that he would die. And I lost my page. So that's 1960. And then 1970, I turn up on my first Sri Ratna retreat. So my first contact with Sri Ratna, my first meeting with Bhante. And I've described that meeting many times, and I've written about it many times, so I'm not going to go into detail about that now, but he had an extraordinary, made an extraordinary impression on me. He turned up on the retreat that I was on. He'd come back from America, there he was. And in the evening, I felt I had a direct experience of the Dharma's truth through him. It's a very kind of foundational experience in my life that's never left me. So he became, in that moment, my teacher. The next day we learned that he'd been taken very ill overnight and nearly died. So I didn't see him again for another couple of months. He must have recovered and gone back to the States. And then, so I've had this really vivid meeting with this person, so kind of crucial in my life, and then he just disappears, as it were. So sometime later, I read his own account of that near-death experience. There's a piece called In Retrospect, which you can read on his website. It's about that year, 1970. So what had happened is he'd gone to the States on a teaching tour. He was on his way back and he got a very bad chill. He'd gone out for a walk in Central Park with some friends. He'd come back to England. He'd gone to bed for a couple of days, hoping that he could, you know, throw it off. Come on the retreat, met me. Had a huge effect on me. So what was important, really, wasn't it? But then went to bed and felt really, really ill. So he says, "At 10 o'clock, I retired to bed. At 11, however, in response to an irresistible inner compulsion, I got out of bed and sat cross-legged in an armchair. I knew that if I continued lying down or dropped off to sleep, I might never open my eyes again." He had a friend sitting with him at the time. He says, "Though feeling physically very unwell, I was in a deeply meditative mood. Though I saw that I could easily die, this thought did not disturb me in the least. Like the two empty pans of a scale, desire for life and desire for death hung exactly balanced, without even the shadow of a turning in either direction. My mood was one of profound tranquility." That's quite strong, isn't it? And obviously he's had that previous experience of, like, I know that I'm going to die. So his friend asks him what's going on, and he tries to explain what he's feeling to his friend who's looking after him. And the friend becomes upset and says, "You mustn't go away yet. I need you. We need you. We all need you too much." And he says, "It was as though a hair had been placed on the pan of life, so that by an infinitesimal fraction, desire for life outweighed desire for death. From that instant, I felt energy beginning to flow in me, and I went back to bed and slept soundly. But the experience left me with a permanent impression. I'm convinced that dying is, or at least can be, a pleasant rather than unpleasant experience. I also felt I might not have as much time in which to finish my work as I had previously thought, so I knew that I had to make the best possible use of every hour remaining to me. Therefore, set your goal, make use of every day and night to achieve it. So it's interesting that he had that experience, that really strong confrontation with death back in 1970. So in 2016, Christmas, New Year, he becomes, so this time he's quite old, isn't he? He's 90-something, one, two. He gets ill with pneumonia. He gets taken to hospital. And some people say, who were around him at the time, that they didn't actually expect him to survive that bout of pneumonia, but he did. And he goes back to Adistan. He's still quite unwell, and he's determined to write this, what became known as his statement, or his apology, or his confession. Very, very strong. I'm not going to read it all to you because you've probably read it and you can read it anyway. But it was in the light of that being so sick with pneumonia, and in the light of the fact that he says next year we're going to be celebrating the 50th anniversary of Tri Ratna. And that will be an occasion for rejoicing, thankfulness for the three jewels, and rededication to the ideals for which Tri Ratna stands. And then his confession is that I, being its founder, Tri Ratna, sometimes bears the marks not of the Dharma, but of my own particular personality. That personality is a complex one, and in certain respects, I did not act in accordance with what my position in the movement demanded, or even as a true Buddhist. I am thinking in particular of the times when I've hurt, harmed, or upset fellow Buddhists, whether within Tri Ratna or out of it. I would therefore like to express my deep regret for all the occasions on which I have hurt, harmed, or upset fellow Buddhists and ask for their forgiveness. So it's not that Bhante said he was perfect before that. It's not that he hadn't expressed regrets or made apology for things he's done, but this was a public statement that made quite a difference. It was written. It was there for posterity. It was on websites. Previously it had been sort of in interpersonal communication. So essentially, many people were delighted by that. Some people were relieved. Great, you know, now it's public, it's out there, this is part of our history, it's clear. But not everybody was, is the way it goes, isn't it? Some people thought he hadn't confessed enough or in enough detail. It wasn't good enough, really. So I had a very interesting conversation with a friend of mine who's very skilled in restorative process, restorative justice, about the nature of public apology. And she said, well, that's the nature of public apology. And by its nature, it's kind of general. It's not going to go into lots of detail. It's not going to name lots of names necessarily. And some people will think that's great. Some people think that's not enough. Some people think, why did you even do that? You didn't need to do it. So it's just left like that. And it's very different from if you're engaged in a personal, interpersonal confession, remorse, making amends, where you hope that there'll be, you know, deep personal resolution. So what interested me, apart from the effect it had on the movement, which was huge in all sorts of different ways, and the effect it had on individuals, later on was the effect I thought it had on Bhante, because it was his confession and his apology. So he seemed to recover from that illness and have a renewal of energy. He saw so many people in those last 2 years of his life. I think Shtana Shraddha somewhere has listed the number of people that he saw. So he's in his late 90s. He's not physically strong, but he just wanted to see people. And so many people, not everybody, but so many people were very deeply affected by their meetings with him, sometimes even transformed. So I think he gave of himself very generously after that sort of death experience and making his confession. He said also he thought the last year of his life was one of the happiest of his life. So there's a very old friend of Bhante's, an order member called Vasantra, who's met Bhante many, many, many times, and he met Bhante this particular phase in those last 2 years while Vasantra was leading a retreat at Adistan. He was very, very, very strongly affected by that meeting. Apparently he went back to his retreat team and said, I think Sangharaksha the grey has transformed into Sangharaksha the white. So you, those of you who know your Lord of the Rings, you know what that means, don't you? It's a very strong image, isn't it? So Gandalf the Grey is the wizard in Lord of the Rings. You know that? You'll be shaking your head, oh dear. Educate this woman. So Gandalf is a wizard, and he's had this great fight with the Balrog on the bridge of wherever, I can't remember the name, and they fall into the abyss. And he defeats the Balrog, who's kind of evil, but he himself dies, and they're in these, down in the pits under Moria, wherever it is. But he's brought back by the elves. He hasn't finished his work. He hasn't defeated Sauron, which is a big baddie. And he's brought back by the elves on the back of the eagle. And he becomes Gandalf the White. So he's more powerful than ever before. So it's just a story, isn't it? But it just sort of expresses something of how some people felt meeting Bante in that phase, those last couple of years. Not the only story, but that's one. So my own reflections on his confession and apology and its effect on him was that, of course, there are many ways of confessing. You can confess in front of a shrine, in front of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. But what's important of a true feeling of remorse and a true feeling of confession is the effect it has on you. And traditionally, the effect that has on you is you experience feelings of joy. You feel pamoja, which Bante has said is one of the most positive and skillful mental states that you can feel. So in the spiral path, we reflect on dukkha, that gives rise to shraddha or faith. And in some instances, that's made more explicit, and faith includes remorse and regret and confession. That leads to a state of mind where you feel free from regret, and that blossoms into this joy, this joyfulness. That feeling that you have nothing to reproach yourself with. You're cheerful, you're content, you're congruent, you have no conflict, you're at peace. I think it also says something, it's like you have a song in your lips. It's that kind of feeling. It's not that I thought that Bante had never felt joy in his spiritual life before. Of course, he must have done, he did. But in this particular phase of his life, he just seemed so free and so open and so joyful and so loving, actually more loving in a way than I thought he had been in the past. So I felt that his confession, whatever anybody else feels, that's up to you, but I felt that his confession had been complete, that it had that effect. So he did, he was around to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the order that he founded. He had another birthday, his 92nd birthday. And then, as we know, late last year, he has another bout of pneumonia. That seems to be the thing, isn't it? Which this time turns into sepsis, and quite quickly he dies. He's not ill for very long. But there is a story, he's still conscious, and he's just asked the doctor, the doctor's given him the prognosis, and Bante said to the doctor, "So are you saying that's fatal?" And the doctor's sort of obfuscating a bit, you know. And eventually says, yes, it's fatal. And Bante apparently turns to one of his companions and says, "You better take those audiobooks back to the library." So it's just very touching and human, isn't it? Very pragmatic. That's got to go. But then quite quickly, he does kind of lose consciousness, and this is Suvajra writing this. He says that I and Paramartha were meditating with Bante. It wasn't too long before Sangadasa and Yashodeva turned up, and as soon as they did, Bante's breathing began to fade. Sangadasa had brought Bante's kesa, so he and Paramartha put Bante's kesa around his neck. He was already holding his mala. As soon as they had done so, within minutes, Bante's breath had stopped, and I had the definite impression that he'd left his body. So it was very sort of smooth letting go at that point. So Paramartha led us in a recitation of the Sevenfold Puja with mantras, a reading on the six Bardo verses, and a recitation of the Heart Sutra. And then we meditated and sat with Bante and spoke of our feelings of joy and appreciation for the life Bante had lived. It really was a very peaceful death, one that Bante seemed entirely prepared for. So a good ending. So we explored recollection on death and impermanence. Death is certain, the means and manner is uncertain, and we can rely on the Dharma. We've also looked at the last days of the Buddha and learnt about something about letting go from his own experience. I also think the Buddha travelled and taught right up to his last days. He was very generous of spirit. He wanted to communicate the Dharma. He's full of compassion. And in a way, although Bante didn't travel in his own way, he was much older and frailer, he saw so many people, he wanted to communicate, he wanted to meet as many people as possible. So the spirit of generosity in both their lives and both their time before they were dead. So maybe we can ask, well, what of our last days? How are we going to live our last days? How are we going to live now? I suppose that's the question that it raises, isn't it? How are we going to live now? And I guess we need to live as much as we can with an awareness of our own mortality, of our own death, in the midst of youth, which is not that easy. It's easier when you get older. In the midst of life, in the midst of health. And be open to contemplating impermanence, whether that's through nature, watching the leaves fall, the blossoms falling, the raindrops falling, or being able to just turn towards our own death, the contemplation of death. And learning to let go whenever we can, wherever we can, however we can. And to do that, we do need to develop a momentum of skillful creative practice, that uninterrupted stream of skillful mental states, as a basis to meet whatever adversity arises with joy and equanimity. We need to understand that no last-minute practices. The power practice won't help us. The mindfulness of breathing, yes. So that now we engage creatively with those practices. Whatever inspires us the most, do them as wholeheartedly as possible. And then I think we will be able to meet death creatively when it comes. I think we can be confident that by applying ourselves to practice wholeheartedly now, we will meet it with courage when it comes. So of all footprints, that of the elephant are supreme. Of all mindfulness meditations, that on death is supreme. It's a great gift to be able to come together on Parinirvana Day and focus on death and dying in all sorts of different ways, to talk about it, to reflect on it, to think about the people we've lost in the last year or so. I think it enables us to live more vividly, more vibrantly, to face our fear when it arises, because it will arise, to care more deeply for others, because we're all going to die at some point, to open our hearts to others. So I think we can allow ourselves and others to be as the tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being.